is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Africa is one of the most vulnerable continents to climate change and climate vulnerability, a situation that unfortunately has been aggravated by the COVID-19 pandemic.
That was Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta addressing a virtual meeting of African heads of states to push the world to do more to fight climate change on the continent, and details coming up. Also, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has warned Ethiopia of possible conflict over its Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile, and South African governments are debating on how to respond to the growing Islamic State-linked insurgency in Mozambique. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. African heads of state met virtually this week to make a push for the global community to do more to fight climate change in Africa, arguing that this environmental crisis could and, in fact, is making the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic worse in the developing world. They are pushing a bold multi-billion dollar plan to change that. VOA's Anita Powell listened in and reports from Johannesburg.
A pandemic has blanketed the planet. Economies have cratered. Across the world, people are scared, anxious, and unsteady about the future. And you want to talk about climate change? Yes, say African leaders. Now. This week, as many nations headed into a third pandemic wave, African leaders stood up ahead of a vital climate conference planned for later this year and made their case for why the world needs to do more now to help Africa adapt to climate change. It is hardly news that the pandemic has dealt a body blow to the developing world, says Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. But he says it has affected everything.
Africa is one of the most vulnerable continents to climate change and climate vulnerability, a situation that unfortunately has been aggravated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Multiple systemic shocks are now simultaneously threatening African communities, and a health crisis, an economic crisis, a food security crisis have all been compounded by this subject that we are continuously debating, that of the climate change crisis. The impact, therefore, of the COVID-19 pandemic on Africa's social economic development has been devastating.
Or, as President Ali Bongo Ndimba of Gabon put it, in a way that will seem familiar to residents of this vast continent that is larger than the combined landmass of the United States, China, and Brazil.
Every day, the thunderstorms seem more violent, flooding is more frequent, and droughts more severe. Around the world, forests are ablaze, crops are failing, people are being forced to flee their homes, becoming climate refugees. Sea levels are rising, potentially drowning cities and even entire countries. The oceans are turning to acid, and salt is penetrating crop lands, posing further serious challenges to food security. Ladies and gentlemen, Excellencies, Africa contributed just 3% of global emissions, but we are the continent which will pay, indeed, which is already paying the biggest price.
What does this have to do with the pandemic? Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the director of the World Health Organization, draws that line clearly. Although the continent has reported a relatively low number of cases compared to other regions, it has seen the world's slowest rollout of vaccination campaigns.
The health sector is one of the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and a key priority sector for adaptation. Despite this, only 0.5% of multilateral climate finance is currently spent on health protection, financing the overall health response to the pandemic and the climate crisis is essential to save lives and drive a social and economic recovery.
these leaders are pushing the global community to put their money behind their commitment. With this plan, laid out by African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina.
Our goal is to mobilize $25 billion for climate adaptation for Africa. The African Adaptation Acceleration Program will build on what is working and speed up the actualization of the African Adaptation Initiative of the African Union.
That is not an abstract plan, he said. It translates to the following tangible steps. Digital climate information and advisory services for 30 million farms. A plan to build more resilient infrastructure in cities and rural areas. Greater involvement from the private sector. Greater emphasis on green investments. More jobs in climate-resilient fields for young people. It is ambitious, big, and bold from a continent that is all of those things. African leaders will take this to the floor of the 26th UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, Scotland, in November. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has warned Ethiopia of possible conflict over its Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile after talks involving the two countries and Sudan ended without progress. Ethiopia's water minister Seleshi Bakala said he had no comment on Sisi's statement. David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East Center for Security Studies, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what such a warning could lead to and possible scenarios for Egyptian military action.
Well, it leads to conflict. I mean, I think Egypt's position here is that the water is theirs. I think Ethiopia's position is, no, the water, it's in our country, it's ours. I think what Egypt is trying to do now is to get other people vested in this problem, to bring in international powers to try to mediate and really force the Ethiopians to moderate their position towards the Egyptian position, because nobody wants to see war break out.
Ethiopia's water minister, Seleshi Bekele, said he had no comment on Sisi's statement, and he said, "We are not utilizing water generated from Egypt or Sudan, as water does not flow upstream to Ethiopia." He said Ethiopia could not enter into an agreement that infringed on its rights to utilize the Nile. What do you make of that?
That's really discouraging, because basically that's sort of the absolutist statement. Egypt views some of the water from the Nile, whether it goes from the White Nile or the Blue Nile, all the way up, you know, to Lake Albert and beyond, as being its water. Ethiopia here is saying, nope, what's in our country is ours, and what's downstream, whatever we allow to go downstream, you know, be happy for it. This is a position that has been problems in rivers that flow through other countries. The Colorado River in the United States is almost completely empty by the time it crosses into Mexico because so much water is taken out of it. In the past, there was conflicts when Turkey built the Ataturk Dam. Both Syria and Iraq were concerned about water levels being removed. And right now, China is building multiple dams across the Mekong River that will stop the flow of water into Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So this is a problem in international relations. And unfortunately, the Ethiopian position is one that greatly concerns Egypt. But, you know, Egypt is so dependent on the Nile, they can't just grin and bear it.
Sisi said, "I'm telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach the point where you touch a drop of Egypt's water, because all options are open." News reports said that Egyptian special forces are positioned already in Sudan. So if Egypt decided to resort to a military action, what kind of military operations would be available to Egypt?
Well, Egypt has a very capable military, particularly for conventional operations. If they're operating in conjunction with Sudan, they obviously would be able to stage raids in and out. I don't think this would be a special forces kind of activity where a small group of people would set charges. It's very, very hard to destroy a project of this magnitude. I think you'd have to militarily, an aerial bombardment would be what would be necessary. Egypt could do it from Sudanese bases without having to refuel. So that is in the realm of the possibility. But once that happens, they could do it once, and then Ethiopia would probably invest in significant air defenses and just rebuild the dam with the assumption of no goodwill. So in the long term, that would be a loss for Egypt. Egypt has to find a way to collaborate with Ethiopia on this, and Sudan does as well. And that's going to be hard because right now, Ethiopia rejects the concept that any of this water is Egypt's.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East Center for Security Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shinawi. Southern African governments are debating on how to respond to the growing Islamic State-linked insurgency in Mozambique's gas-rich Cabo Delgado province. One major question is what threat the insurgents pose to neighboring countries. VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Ryan Cummings in Cape Town, South Africa. Cummings is director of Signal Risk, a South Africa-based security analysis and risk management company.
So first of all, Ryan, this insurgency is focused in Cabo Delgado, but what's the threat of it expanding beyond that province in Mozambique or across borders?
Yeah, I think the key issue at the moment is if we look at the violence, it's very much concentrated in the northernmost districts of Cabo Delgado province. But what we've seen over the past, 24 months or so, and specifically the last year, is kind of the southward expansion of the violence. There's been a few attacks closer to the town of Pemba. The other issue probably relates to a northward spread of the insurgency across the Mozambican borders into neighboring Tanzania. We have seen, some accounts of Tanzanian border patrols arresting suspected insurgents. I think there was one exchanged along the Rovuma River on the Tanzanian side of the border, which indicated a potential militant presence, within Tanzanian territory, and also the capabilities of this group to potentially extend the insurgents' operations within Tanzania as well.
And now let's look at South Africa, because there have been reports of South African nationals having joined the insurgents. What do we know about that?
Very little at this stage. I mean, the Hawks agency, which is one of the security agencies in South Africa, they've specifically referenced the fact that South Africans have joined the Al-Suna network in northern Mozambique. Motivations for their decision were not disclosed, but just from assessing the likely motivation for South Africans to join this group may be rooted to Al-Suna's alliance affiliation with the Islamic State. We know in South Africa that the Islamic State ideology has gained resonance among some members of the population. We know that South Africans had traveled to Iraq and Syria to fight for the group. And basically, Al-Suna's alignment and acceptance by the Islamic State as one of its affiliates may be the actual factor at this stage, which is drawing South Africans to northern Mozambique to engage in this conflict or insurgency.
Does that mean that South Africa could be at risk of attacks?
There has been direct threats made by the Islamic State against South Africa in relation to this insurgency. In last September, they issued a statement in the Al-Naba publication, specifically warning South Africa that if it does intend to militarily involve itself in the insurgency in Cabo Delgado, that it will conduct reprisals within South Africa's borders, stating that this could potentially come from militants across in Mozambique or even potentially from within South Africa itself.
And along those lines, there has been some kind of intervention from South Africa. There's the Dyke Advisory Group, this private military contractor, some call them mercenaries, which has been deployed. The South African military also sent troops to help with evacuations. Could there potentially be blowback against South Africa for these sorts of actions?
At this stage, I think that the engagement specifically of the Dyke Advisory Group has, kind of consistent in Mozambique for several months now, and there hasn't been any kind of, punitive violence in South Africa because of that. I think it's the perception that this is not been endorsed by South Africa. It's kind of a private, military contractor that's not representative of South Africa's foreign policy position on this issue. Also, the current deployment of troops that assisted in evacuation involving South Africans in Cabo Delgado province has also not had an offensive mandate. It was more just to kind of ensure the provision of security as South Africans who were potentially impacted by the violence were being repatriated back to the country. So at this stage, obviously, there was little motivation for militants, either based in Mozambique or based in South Africa, to target South Africa in, you know, punitive acts of violence, because that in itself could be the potential catalyst for intervention by the South African military in Mozambique. But the key concern is obviously if South Africa does assume a more offensive mandate, deploys our military to Mozambique, directly engages against these militants, that I think will be the issue which could attract potential threats, either external or internal, to our national security.
That was Ryan Cummings, director of Signal Risk, a security analysis and risk management company, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. The death toll from intercommunal clashes in Sudan's West Darfur region has risen to 132. The fighting between the Masalit and Arab communities started Saturday around the state capital, El Janina. The UN is saying thousands have fled the latest violence, with some escaping to Chad. Mohamed Abdullah Duma, the governor of the region, told the media that the situation is now relatively stable other than some looting. The government of Sudan has declared a state emergency in the region, where United Nations peacekeepers were recently withdrawn. A United States-based company is threatening to withdraw its services from South Africa's embattled national power utility, Eskom. Energy analysts say the country will be plunged into total darkness if computer technology giant Oracle follows through. As it is, Eskom's struggling to keep the lights on following years of mismanagement and alleged corruption at the corporation that reached a peak under former President Jacob Zuma. Regular power outages are now part of everyday life in South Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
Oracle says Eskom owes it hundreds of millions of rands, and if it doesn't pay up, the US company will stop providing technical expertise.
It's not non-payment. There is a contractual dispute.
Sikonathi Manchancha is a spokesperson for South Africa's state power company.
Oracle is claiming that it is owed by Eskom 7.3 billion rands. That was their opening claim. They said Eskom has overused the software and the services, technical support services that Oracle provides. When Eskom disputed the amount, it dropped to 800 million rands, and it further dropped again upon further disputes from Eskom to the current 400 million rands. So Oracle is...
Eskom, however, says it owes Oracle only 166 million rands. It's challenging the service provider to allow an independent auditor to investigate its claim that it's owed more than double this. Oracle says it'll decide soon how to proceed. Manchancha acknowledges that Oracle is very important to Eskom's daily operations.
Oracle provides software on which Eskom relies on to maintain its power stations. We also rely on Oracle's software for services such as online vending for people at home to buy their electricity online. We rely on some of this for distribution of electricity, particularly in areas where people rely on prepaid meters. So there are quite a lot.
Nevertheless, he maintains Eskom has contingency measures in place to prevent widespread power breakdowns should Oracle leave.
Oracle has a contract with Eskom, a binding contract ending in March 2022. And should they pull out, indeed, Eskom has got teams that can take over. That Oracle complements already. We rely on them to add to our internal teams, and these have been brought up to speed in order to fill the void that might be left in the absence of Oracle's technical experts.
But statements like this have left South Africans wondering if Eskom's technicians are able to do all the work that Oracle has been doing. Why is the near-bankrupt utility paying a foreign company hundreds of billions of rands every year? In response, Manchancha says Oracle's contract will be reviewed when it expires. He insists analysts are plain wrong when they say the dispute's going to result in long blackouts across South Africa.
We will have some glitches on online vending where people might be disrupted or their ability to pay for electricity online might be disrupted. We may have a few issues where we are not exactly able to use the software to plan for maintenance. Yes, there might indeed be some disturbances in the event that we might have a breakdown here and there.
Glitches, issues, disturbances. When South Africans hear words like these from an Eskom spokesperson, they shudder. For the past 12 years, the state power companies blamed nationwide blackouts on glitches, issues and disturbances, and winter's just begun. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And in a related story, a terminally ill South African man who relies on an oxygen machine is praying the government will soon resolve the electricity crisis. Paul Adams says he cannot use his machine when the power goes out, as happens far too often, and has spent months battling to have his two backup non-electric oxygen tanks refilled by the state. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to him in Cape Town.
57-year-old Adams from the working-class suburb of Mitchells Plain was diagnosed with emphysema 2 years ago.
It's the end of stage four, which means there's actually nothing they can do now except for the oxygen that's without me.
Unemployed Adams says some days he has to spend up to 4 hours on an oxygen machine, which guzzles electricity that eats up his entire disability grant of 1,700 rand a month from the government. It's not just the high cost, but the unreliability of the power supply that makes him angry and anxious. The father and grandfather says he's dreading winter when power cuts, known as load shedding by state-owned utility Eskom, increase.
Now the load shedding, I'm one. I wouldn't even want my worst enemy to go through the situation that I go through when it comes to that. Because even what to do, it's times I must jump up. I must go outside in the middle of the night. My tank is empty. I can't breathe. It's scary.
Adams has two backup non-electric oxygen tanks that are meant to be used when the power goes, but he hasn't had any oxygen in them since August when he was admitted to hospital for COVID-19. He says a doctor organized for one of his tanks to be refilled when he was discharged.
What the doctor did, I don't know. But that guy that came here was for one tank, and that one tank only lasted me for a day, believe it or not. Only for a day. And since that, I'm phoning Raven, I'm phoning. We're going from pillow to post, but no go.
A nurse from St. Luke's Hospice, Sister Dawn Juice, who assists Adams, believes there may be a shortage of oxygen because of COVID-19. She's appealed to the government to prioritize patients in palliative care by somehow stabilizing their electricity supply and making sure they have oxygen if they need it.
The fear is always there, and when they become frightened, Their air pipes even closes off more. So yes, they become very, very anxious.
The Western Cape Department of Health has denied there is a shortage of oxygen and has promised to investigate the matter. Meanwhile, the Chief Executive Officer of Eskom, Andre De Reuter, warned just last month that power cuts, which started way back in 2007, would continue for another 5 years. Aging coal power plants and failure to speedily bring alternative energy sources on board have been blamed for the shortage. The last financial year saw 43 days of load shedding after 46 the previous year. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.